Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, the bipartisan National War Powers Commission released a report calling for Congress and the President to work together in a new way when the country is considering war. The law currently on the books is ineffective, they said. Here's former Secretary of State James Baker, who co-chaired the commission with former Secretary of State Warren Christopher.
Our commission has unanimously concluded that the central law governing this critical decision, that is, the War Powers Resolution of 1973, is ineffective, and it should be repealed, and it should be replaced, however, with a better law.
As rumors of U.S. war planning for Iran swirl in Washington, this is not a hypothetical issue. Who decides and how? This hour, On Point, War Powers in America. We will hear in this hour from War Powers Commission member, former Republican Senator Slade Gorton of Washington State, and from conservative legal scholar Robert Turner at the University of Virginia. But first, joining me from Concord, Massachusetts, is Doris Kearns Goodwin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and presidential historian. She served as historical advisor to the National War Powers Commission, participating in the commission's meetings and authoring sections of the report released yesterday. Doris Kearns Goodwin, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Very glad to be with you.
And with us from Princeton, New Jersey, is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, congressional scholar, author of the forthcoming book, Washington Warfare, The Politics of National Security Since World War II. Julian Zelizer, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, we're going to ask you to walk us through the proposal that's been put on the table here. But first, if you would, you were in these meetings, you followed along and advised on history and more. What, as you understand it, what was the primary motivation for this commission and its proposal?
I think the primary motivation was the realization on both sides, the Congress and the President, that the current law that was put into practice after the Vietnam War in 1973 was being ignored by the presidents, who thought it was unconstitutional. The Congress didn't feel it was getting what it wanted out of it, and yet we know that it's so important when a country goes to war that you have the maximum kind of collaboration. So at the beginning, there was no necessary thought that they'd replace that War Powers Act with this idea. It was more just sorting through what did the framers say, where did we go on who's commander-in-chief, who's got the power to declare war, and all of that is so muddled because that's probably what the framers wanted. So then we looked back to what are the lessons that history has taught in terms of when collaboration has made a good thing happen, when lack of it has made bad things happen, and then sort of worked their way through to this new idea of what this law should be.
Now remind us, you're our historian, right there in the bedrock of the Constitution, what it says. On the surface, it seems clear. I mean, Congress is granted the power to declare war, almost period.
However, the president is commander-in-chief. So, you know, I think what's happened over time is that even some presidents have argued that, yes, only Congress can do it. Yes, I can do it. So practice has allowed, I think, presidents, because of the need to act quickly, because of imminent things coming up, to take those actions, and then executive power got expanded over time because of that. And yet Congress has still argued rightly that in the Constitution it should have a major role to declare war. But then what's happened over time is, what is war? So we get into some conflicts that people say, well, this isn't really war, and then they get extended from what they started to be, and you didn't need the declaration at the beginning, but maybe you should have had it as you go along. So practical reality has made us have to look more carefully at a solution that hopefully both sides will agree to.
Doris, can you lay out the key elements then of what this collaboration, as you put it, would look like if this is picked up, and we'll talk about that, if this should become law, under what was laid out and proposed yesterday with Baker and Christopher at the head, what would the process look like for the U.S. considering a move to war?
Well, what it would mean is, and it gives something to both sides in a sense, for the president, this law would only require him to make this collaboration when there's significant armed conflict. The problem with the War Powers Resolution before was that the act earlier, it didn't define what was significant in a certain sense. It also has exceptions in there if there's a need for acting quickly, et cetera, et cetera. But, and it reverses the presumption from the old act that before what they were saying in 1973 was if after 90 days the president has started some sort of a conflict, then the Congress, if they don't approve it, that inaction means disapproval. Here what they're saying is the following. Before a president goes to war, and always during a series of time before that, he's going to have collaboration with the Congress. There's going to be set up in the Congress a joint congressional committee that is included with the chiefs of the majority leader, the minority leader, the heads of the committees, and it's a collaborative committee that has a permanent staff, which means that every 2 months during this period of time, a president would consult with this committee, and there'd be collaboration before you even think of going to war. Then, if he decides that it's time to go to war, and he, then what would happen is if he obviously could go to a declaration of war at the beginning, and then no problem at all. The Congress is with you from the beginning.
That is, if Congress went straight to a full declaration.
Of course. Then this whole thing, you know, doesn't matter. That, that would be fine. But if he doesn't, and he goes to war, then what happens is that in a week's time, then the Congress has to, if it's a significant conflict, not one of these smaller ones, then the Congress has to decide, you put the onus on them to approve his actions.
Now, I thought, what I was reading was that he had to consult with lawmakers before initiating combat that might last longer than a week. Have I got that right?
No, that's exactly right. In fact, that may be the most valuable part of all this, because what it's arguing is that you want to have the best advice. You don't want an echo chamber inside the White House where only a small group of people make this huge decision about taking a country to war. You've got to trust that if you get the top lawmakers in the Congress and you've got a classified information going to them, you've got a permanent staff going to them.
A staff with access to military and intelligence material.
That's right, and he will be sharing that information in the weeks and the months leading up to a decision. I think that may be the most important part of this whole thing.
So he couldn't even push the button for a one-week conflict without that consultation, and then if something does begin, he has how long to go back for a positive vote by the Congress?
And if, then if something begins, then Congress has 30 days to approve it or to disapprove it.
And if they do nothing?
Now, they can't do nothing. See, that's the good thing. They have to do something. The problem with the way it is now is they can just not do anything, and then presumably that ends the conflict, according to the War Powers Resolution. So now, once a major operation begins, Congress has 30 days to approve it or disapprove it, unless, of course, as we said, they authorized it in advance. Now, if the Congress votes, this does get complicated, but if the Congress votes to disapprove it, the president can still veto it, and then the Congress would have to override the veto. So that you're, what you're trying to assure, however, is that you've got broad bipartisan support when you have something as basic as going to war. And this gives the Congress a responsibility to really act. I think part of the problem in the past is Congress leaves the president to make these decisions, then they get angry later along the line, and then the only resort they have is to cut off the funding once the soldiers are in the field, and that becomes a really difficult act, as we've seen. So this way it brings them into the process earlier on and makes them have to make a decision, and they're with the president. You know, Lyndon Johnson used to say they should be, if you're going to be with you on the landing, they should be with you on the takeoff. You know, you've got to have them in both sides of the struggle.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, we'll ask you to put this in historical context for us. This the War Powers Consultation Act of 2009, as Baker and Christopher put it forward from this commission yesterday. Julian Zelizer, give us your perspective on this. 1973, the idea was to rein in the president's power to deploy forces into war abroad. Now we're being told it's not sufficient, it hasn't worked, this would be better. Does this look better to you?
I think it's a good step, but it's a limited step. I think the best part of the report, as we just discussed, is the consultation. It's always good to have more mechanisms where the legislative and executive branches talk about sending troops before it happens rather than after it happens. It's good to have the sharing of information. And I think in that respect, the committee report is, the commission report is good. That said, I think there's a lot of problems in terms of executive war power that this simply won't solve. I think in some ways you can't legislate this problem. I ultimately think it's a problem where Congress has to either take action or not take action. And it has a lot of tools at its disposal already. But in terms of kind of voting to approve or disapprove after the war has begun, I don't think it's that different, frankly, from what Congress already has.
How significant is consultation itself? I think a lot of Americans have grown skeptical about that. The president invites you over for, for a drink. You go back up on Capitol Hill and war is declared. And he says, we've had a consultation.
Well, it happens that way sometimes, but often there is consultation. I mean, if you go before 1973, when Lyndon Johnson decides to accelerate the war in Vietnam, there's a lot of consultation informally that takes place. We've heard it in the phone calls where legislators are saying, don't do this. And Johnson ultimately does it and they go along. That wasn't a case of lack of consultation. That was a case of poor judgment and Congress ultimately acquiescing with the Gulf of Tonkin for political reasons as much as strategic reasons. 2002, 2003, we saw Congress again go with the move toward Iraq. One argument is there was no consultation. Another argument is Republicans knew what was going on. They had a lot of consultation and a Republican Congress made that decision, and now they're not so happy with it, and Democrats have control. So consultation sometimes happens, and it's not often the reason we go to war or allow troops to be sent.
So do you see this, we've got 20 seconds before the break, as reining in executive war power or, in a way, validating it?
I think some critics will say it validates it. It puts Congress to be a consultant rather than a decision maker, as in the Constitution. But again, information and discussion is always good, so I would not criticize that part of the report.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about a big bipartisan call to revamp the War Powers Act, to try to nail down, again, the roles of the White House and Congress in deciding when America goes to war. We've been joined by Pulitzer Prize winner Doris Kearns Goodwin. She was historical advisor to the commission that's just met for a year and reported yesterday, sat in on many of those meetings. Julian Zelizer joins us from Princeton University. We'll be joined in a moment by Robert Turner from the University of Virginia. Let's go straight to a call from Toronto, Canada. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes. First of all, thank you for this fascinating and topical discussion, and I'm delighted to hear the presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Mm. And my question is addressed to her. Who does she think wields the most influence over President Bush in taking a decision to go and strike, perhaps, or do a preemptive operation against Iran? What is the mechanism involved in the White House? Is it the Secretary of State? Is it Dick Cheney? Is it the CIA director? Is there a kind of war cabinet consultation that takes place? How does it actually work?
Michael, thanks for that from Toronto. Doris Kearns Goodwin, how about it? Let's look at how it works right now and how it would, might work under the commission's proposal. It's staring us right in the face. Iran.
No, exactly so. I mean, as it currently works, and not only in President Bush, but in previous administrations, but perhaps even more so in this one, there is that internal circle within the White House, which means the National Security Advisor, Secretary of State, sometimes less, sometimes more. As we saw with Iraq, the Vice President, Cheney, was very important. The difference would be if this provision were already, if this law were already a statute, that in these weeks, even thinking about what might happen to Iran, the president would have had to have been sharing information, intelligence, classified stuff with the top group of lawmakers in a regularized fashion. He would have met with them every couple months at least, and they would have been talking about what do we do about Iran in a way that would be deeper and more profound than the kind of talks that he may have informally with various members of Congress right now.
I want to go further, but let me just ask you about that. We've seen this White House in the past not want to have that kind of open conversation. Let's imagine, I have no idea, I'm not a military guy, but let's imagine the president's thinking, okay, this nuclear program's gone too far, to hell with it, we're going to go in there with massive air attacks, but it's going to take less than a week. It's going to take 6 days, so I don't need to talk to Congress. We're going to do it in 6 days, take out Iran's nuclear facilities, and so who needs this consultation? Is that possible? Is that permittable?
Well, there are exceptions that if there's a danger of an imminent attack upon us or something where the secrecy absolutely demands that you take the action, but then you still have to come back to the Congress in that very short period right after and keep this going. Obviously, one has to worry about leaks, but, you know, as we talked about the process of leaks, leaks often come from the White House as well as from the Congress. It is true, the more people that you spread information to, the more chance there is of leaking. But we have to just trust that these people are in these high positions of responsibility in the Congress. If they're brought in on a regular basis, they know this is a new role that they will be playing in a much more serious way than before, that you've got to they've got to be responsible just as the president is. And there's no more reason to believe they're going to be leaking any more than the people in the White House.
But could they stop the president, this consultative committee in Congress, if they wanted to? They'd be talking to him then, I guess, but would they have the power to stop him, or could he consult and go ahead no matter what?
No, he can go ahead, but then the question is, they have to come. Then he has to come back, and they have to approve or disapprove this thing within a period of time afterwards.
But a month in, within a month, by that time, if Tehran is true to its word, we'd see stuff blowing up all over the place, and we'd be at war.
And that's the problem we face in our modern world with the kind of attacks that an executive can launch. You're absolutely right. The hope still, however, is that by having the Congress in there talking about it beforehand, you're getting more voices so that if it's not the right thing to do or if it's a difficult situation, like even in Iraq, for example, let's just go back to that for a moment. What some of the congressmen later argued was that they didn't have the full range of information, that they weren't given all the intelligence that they should have to make that decision when they did.
October 16th, 2002, authorization right
Correct.
There.
Now, they had materials that they could have gone to read, presumably that they didn't hopefully read as much as they should have. But here in this case, hopefully what you would have had was Congress much more a part of that process, deeper into the intelligence, deeper into some of the problems with that intelligence that we later discovered, so that maybe they would not have authorized the action that they did had they been more collaborative in the beginning.
We're going to get a conservative scholar's view on this in just 1 minute, but Julian Zelizer, first to you. On the Iran front, take us as an example. Game it with this commission's proposal. Do you think it would break, slow, deepen the consideration over war with potentially Iran, for example?
It could slow the consideration. It could give Congress, Congress that's nervous about this, more information and ammunition to attack the president, to criticize the president if they disagree with it. But ultimately, what you said is true. The president, if he wanted to do that, could do that. And he has the power of the modern executive to send those troops to authorize that strike. And this particular commission report would not stop the action. All that would stop the action is Congress using either the power of the purse, the power of the hearings, or other powers once this was underway if they fundamentally didn't agree with it. So it shows some of the limits of what would happen after troops are sent. I think, again, the benefit would be early on Congress would have more information about what's really going on. If I could just add, though, with Iraq, there was a lot of information there. One of the problems was legislators didn't look at it seriously. It wasn't just lack of information. It was not processing information. And there was also a lot of political pressure in 2002 not to challenge the president, both parties. And I think that was an equally important consideration. It might play out differently now, kind of given the context of Iraq and all the problems. So those are two of the challenges, I think, that the commission report would face.
Both then and in this Iran hypothetical, I have to say, though, it leaves the congressional power to declare war looking somehow kind of lame. Let's bring a conservative perspective in here with Robert F. Turner, law professor at the University of Virginia, leading scholar of war powers issues, founder of UVA's Center for National Security Law, served in the Reagan administration, the State and Defense Departments, served two army tours in Vietnam. Robert Turner, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, I'm glad to be here again.
You heard James Baker and Warren Christopher yesterday, Doris Kearns Goodwin, who advised the commission today, and we'll hear from Senator Gorton of Washington State. You've been a defender of executive powers when it comes to military action. Do you see this as a good proposal? Do you think it would tie the president's hands too much?
Well, it has some potential problems, but what it does, first of all, is repeal the War Powers Resolution, which was an unconstitutional fraud. I've written two books on the War Powers Resolution, and if you look back at the history on this, anyway, if you look back on the history, you know, we were all told that Korea was an imperial president ignoring Congress. that the once top secret records are now available. Truman repeat. In fact, as soon as he got back from Missouri, he said, "I want to go before a joint session of Congress. Acheson, have your best minds draft a resolution of approval and so forth." Everybody he met with in Congress said, "Stay away from Congress. You've got the power to do this under the UN Charter and under the Constitution." Truman ultimately said, "Well, if you guys don't think I should do it, I won't push it." As soon as the war became unpopular, Richard Nixon and a number of other Republican conservatives denounced him as a, you know, as a crook and a liar and so forth. The same thing is true in Vietnam. Congress passed a statute clearly authorizing war by a 99.6% vote. And LBJ's public opinion approval in the Gallup polls in the months surrounding the Southeast Asia resolution in August of 64 shot up 58%.
But that was after this incident, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was later shown to be kind of, you know, jimmied up and bogus.
That's another myth. Even Hanoi admits the August 2nd attack occurred. There is serious doubt about whether the August 4th attack occurred, but there is no doubt that people on the scene initially reported to the White House, "We've been attacked again." Now, later, they started thinking maybe we didn't see torpedoes, maybe we saw phosphorus strikes, and I have serious doubt about whether that occurred. But the most important thing is we did not go to war in Vietnam because of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. We went to the war in Vietnam as part of the containment policy because North Vietnam had made a decision to overthrow South Vietnam by force.
But with
and
respect,
Hanoi, since the war ended, admitted that it made that decision 5 years before the Southeast Asian resolution was passed.
With respect, Professor Turner, it was then the considered opinion of the Congress after the bitter experience of that war that we needed more restraint on executive war-making power. Do you think it went too far? And would this restore power to the president when it comes to war?
I think what the commission is trying to do is to avoid trying to resolve very difficult constitutional issues. I said earlier the War Powers Resolution was a fraud. In 1966, Jacob Javits said, whether we like it or not, Congress is a full partner in the Vietnam War because of that statute. Even Eagleton, who was a great opponent of the war, said, you know, the Vietnam War was a legal war authorized by Congress. In fact, some of the irony is LBJ didn't deceive Congress into going to war. He didn't want to go to war. He was being dragged into war by Congress and public opinion.
We've got listener questions precisely on this constitutional front. Let me take one from Jackie, if I may, in Melrose, Massachusetts. Excuse me, Professor, but Jackie, you're on.
Hi, Tom. So glad to have this program. I think the new program they're developing is an improvement, but besides that, the Constitution, besides saying that Congress declares war, also says that the Congress maintains the militia, the military, for two reasons: to suppress an insurrection or repel an invasion. And yet, since that statement, marvelous by our great document so many years ago, we've had so many wars that are not related to that at all. Unlike many countries that do have border problems, that's where most of the wars occur because of border differences, but we have a very peaceful situation with two oceans on either side and Canada.
Yeah, but you know, it's a small world after all, Jackie. Missiles don't know oceans. I mean, they fly where they like, right?
But there's no reason for us to attack all the countries we've done since World War II because we have not had an insurrection. We're not revolting. And there is no country that's going to try to invade us. We are the most powerfully armed country in the history of the world.
So do you want more power in the hands of Congress or the White House?
Yes, definitely in the hands of Congress, because all of our presidents have been too eager to hop around the world and attack countries that have done nothing to us.
Jackie, thank you for that. Doris Kearns Goodwin, what about it? I mean, Robert Turner says the commission, in a way, avoided difficult constitutional issues, and it does look difficult. Have we ever figured this out as a country?
No, I mean, I think what the commission realized, as we had various historians come and talk to us about where the framers were in the beginning, what practices took place over time, is that you can argue it either way. So it didn't make any sense to really get into the morass of what was meant by the framers, except to recognize that they gave both the Congress the power to declare war and they made the president commander-in-chief. And in both those places, presidents and Congress have taken power. So it seemed much more beneficial to try and come up with this kind of a practical solution. You know, I mean, what history tells you is that when the Congress and the president do collaborate, things are better. That's the main thing. I mean, for example, look at the contrast between when FDR
felt he had to defend England in those early days before we were in the war, and he decided that Congress would not pass this destroyer bill that he needed. So he actually went and did it on his own in an executive action.
The Lend-Lease stuff.
Well, the Lend-Lease was second.
Okay.
What happens first is, I mean, what's interesting is it shows two different sides of the same situation. He knew he had to act. Congress was isolationist. He didn't think he could get Congress to act. So in the first place, he decided to simply exchange the destroyers for bases, British bases around the world.
Mm.
And he felt the means, just the ends justified the means. But meanwhile, people claimed he was being an arbitrary president. He should be impeached. It was dictatorial. But he felt he had to do it. But then when he got to the Lend-Lease situation later that year, when Britain is reeling under the Blitz and they desperately need our supplies and they no longer have money to pay for them, he decides he has to go to Congress. And the great benefit of his going to Congress, even though it delayed getting those supplies to England, and every day mattered to England's survival, and he knew that, so it was very scary, but it went on for months, the congressional debate. And the wonderful thing that happened was, prior to that debate, the country was not in favor of aid to the Allies. The debate itself shaped public opinion, and by the end of the debate, not only did they approve Lend-Lease, but the country itself, by that time, public opinion had gone in favor of it. And FDR made this great comment. He said, you know, yes, the decisions of democracy may be slowly arrived at, but when that decision is made, it is proclaimed not with the voice of one man, but at that time with the voice of 130 million.
And so came
he himself recognized that this was a good thing, because you've got to have the country behind you if you're going to be in a sustained war.
And then came World War II. Robert Turner, let me just ask you a simple kind of citizen's question here. The Constitution, I've got it in front of me, says, you know, the power to declare war goes to Congress. As Doris says, President is the Commander-in-Chief. Now, the Commander-in-Chief, the Congress raises and supports the armies, they fund the army, they declare war. He or she is the Commander-in-Chief, but that sounds kind of like an employee of the Congress when it comes to war. You know, he's the foreman of the army, but it's been turned, sometimes it seems like, you know, it's his decision to make. Is that how you interpret it, or differently?
No. In fact, in his first Pacificus essay, Alexander Hamilton noted that the power of Congress to declare war was an exception out of the general, quote, executive power vested in the president by Article 2, Section
right.
1, and thus was to be construed strictly. Remember, the original constitutional draft they worked from gave Congress the power to make war, which was the language from the Articles of Confederation. And Madison, in August of 1787, along with Elbridge Gerry, introduced a motion to change make war to declare war, giving the president the right to respond to attacks, but also clarifying that Congress had nothing to do with the conduct of war. Indeed, when that point was made, only a single state, I think it was Connecticut, voted against the change. Now, they took a term of art from the Law of Nations, declare war. If you go back and read what Hugo Grotius, Vattel, the great publicists and legal scholars of the time that they read and quoted, said about it, a formal declaration of war was only associated with a major, quote, offensive, or what we would today call aggressive war, which has been illegal at least since the U.N. Charter, if not the Kellogg-Briand Treaty, and thus no country in the world has formally declared war since the Charter went into effect. So I would argue that the modern developments of international law have made both the power to declare war and the associated power to grant letters of marque and reprisal, which were outlawed in 1858 by treaty, essentially anachronisms. But Congress still has tremendously important powers, both in its power to raise and support armies and in its control. Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution provides that no money can be taken out of the Treasury without appropriation by law. So Congress can stop a war anytime it wants, and as a matter of public policy, involving Congress in the decision of starting major wars. Now, if it's an aggressive war, Congress clearly has a veto. If it's not, if we're acting defensively, the legal case is arguable, but the policy case is very strong for cooperation, which is why I like this report.
Professor Turner at the University of Virginia, thank you for joining us. Anachronism maybe, but we still go to war. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking about a big bipartisan call to revamp the War Powers Act of 1973 to try to nail down, once again, the roles of the White House and Congress in deciding when America goes to war. Big report out yesterday from a bipartisan commission. You saw James Baker and former Secretary of State as well, Warren Christopher, standing front and center on that commission. Lee Hamilton in there, Edwin Meese of Reagan-era fame, Brent Scowcroft was there on the commission, Strobe Talbott, Anne-Marie Slaughter, historical advisor to that commission, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian who's with us today. Julian Zelizer is with us as well from Princeton, New Jersey, at the Woodrow Wilson School there. We'll hear in just a moment from former Senator Slade Gorton of Washington State, who was on the commission. But let's take a call from Dubuque, Iowa, and Mark. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, the professor said that Congress has the power to stop the war at any time by cutting the purse string. And that's not entirely true, because you first have to override his veto, and knowing that the Republicans will never let that happen, that almost is an impossible way to stop a war. But I thought to say that since Congress never actually declared war, how is it that we continue to get in all these skirmishes with these other countries? And I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Mark, we've got it. Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Senator Slade Gorton for that. Former Republican senator from Washington State, 82 to 87, and again 89 to 2001, and of course the Persian Gulf War right in there. Member of the National War Powers Commission that reported yesterday, member of the 9/11 Commission. He joins us from Washington. Senator Gorton, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
You hear our caller Mark's question from Dubuque. He says, you know, does Congress really have power here? Because how are they going to overcome a veto if they on appropriations? And, you know, he's saying, I guess the president seems to have it wrapped up when it comes to war power. You've sat there in the Senate chamber and considered these issues. Do you think we've got the right balance in practice when it comes to this country going to war?
Well, at one level, I don't think we do have quite the right practice, the balance, and one of the primary reasons for that is the total ineffectiveness of the War Powers Act of 1973. That's 35 years ago. No president has ever filed a report pursuant to the War Powers Act, and therefore the limitations that are included in that act on the president's powers to use our armed services have never come into effect.
In other words, they just ignore it, essentially.
They're just ignoring it. Presidents feel that it's unconstitutional. We felt that it's unconstitutional, at least in part. And we would like to have a consultative relationship. And Doris Kearns Goodwin, just a few moments ago, spoke about the fact that we are likely to make decisions more wisely and more carefully if there is a genuine consultation between Congress and the President. This is what we have attempted to set up, a specific congressional committee made up of its leaders with a staff, with all of the information that's available to the President, that consults with him. It doesn't veto him. The President still will have any constitutional power that he claims, but Congress will have a consulting relationship. And once such a conflict starts, Congress will be forced to take a vote. Under the War Powers Act, Congress could, in effect, vote by doing nothing at all. That's unhealthy. So the two main changes in the present ineffective War Powers Act are a regular committee with a staff on the part of Congress, the requirement that the President consult with them, and the requirement that Congress take an actual vote or votes. Moreover, this consultation continues, and this is what would be a real difference with the situation now. While a conflict is going on, the President, under this proposal, will have to consult with this congressional group, bipartisan group, at least once every 2 months. Now, there's been a wonderful debate today on this program about what the Constitution says and how it divides powers. You know from that debate that it's not settled. It hasn't been settled for 220 years. The Supreme Court won't get into it, calling it mostly a political question. We can't settle that. We didn't try to settle that. We tried to set up a situation that works better than the situation we faced for the last 35 years.
Senator, we have listeners paying very, very close attention to what's being proposed here with questions for you. Let me go to Stephen, if I may, in Providence, Rhode Island. Stephen, you're on with Senator Slade Gorton.
Thanks very much. I'd like Senator Gorton and Doris Kearns Goodwin, if she's still there, to go back. I know the commission didn't want to use Iraq as an example, but it is the most recent case study that we've got.
No kidding.
The reality is that our congressional leadership did not look at the intelligence that was there for a very good reason, and that was they were being stampeded by the current administration and by the public opinion that the current administration stirred up. Mushroom cloud, blah, blah, blah. Link Chafee very clearly says he went, he looked, he tried to encourage other senators to look at what he saw. There was no there.
Your former senator there in Rhode Island, yes.
So if we have these key congressional leaders, minority House and Senate leaders and whatnot, sitting down with the president, if they don't have the courage to look at what's really there, they're going to get stampeded anyway. There needs to be some other stricture put into this kind of thing. We can't just say genuine or authentic consultation is somehow going to happen because we're going to rely on the goodwill of the president and the congressional leaders. They failed the last time. Who's going to say that they won't fail again to step up and honestly look at what's there?
Stephen, let me take that to Senator Gorton, and I will, as you ask, go to Doris Kearns Goodwin as well. First, Senator Gorton. What about it? Does the Congress inevitably get stampeded? Does the White House have the bigger bully pulpit when it comes to war?
The comment reminds me of that old saw, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. This is the system that we have. People are fallible. Sometimes they are stampeded. Sometimes they aren't. But the best system that we can set up under our Republican form of government is to see to it that these two elected branches talk to one another and consult with one another, and we will hope that they will come out with wise decisions. There's no structure that can guarantee that every decision is going to be right, but this structure will more likely result in success, in an appropriate decision than does the present one. We on this commission are fairly modest. We don't think we can solve every problem for the next 100 years, but we hope we can make a better lead in to hostilities in the future than we have had in the past.
Doris, you are a historian today. This is recent history, and a lot of it in public now. You know how determined this administration was to go into Iraq. Now, you know, we see what the polls say about how Americans feel about that. Our caller, Stephen, says they got stampeded and they would be stampeded again under this proposal. What do you say in response?
Well, you know, there's no question when you look back to the fall of 2002 that the Congress itself, too, was not willing to take a stand at a time when the midterm elections were coming up, when there was this stampeding feeling in the country. The hope in this new situation is that there you were depending on individual congressmen and senators to go read a report, to make a stand, to go against, and some of them did, majority opinion, but most of them did not. Here you're going to have a joint congressional consultation committee. It's going to be permanently in place. It's going to have a speaker and the majority leader, the minority leaders, and the heads of these various committees on foreign affairs and armed services and intelligence. And hopefully that general process that they are continually in session, they have a staff of their own, they have intelligence of their own, they're going to feel responsible that they are a partner with the president for making this decision. Too often, I think, the Congress, and we talked about this, they push the decision off on the president. Then when it doesn't go well, they get mad at it after the fact. So here, I think, you've got to rely on the good, you know, professionalism and the patriotism of these congressional people, that if they're put in a position where they're given more information, given more responsibility, they will assume it. And I think that will make more collaboration, more caution, perhaps better decisions. That's the hope.
Let's hear from Edward in Afton, Virginia. Edward, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much. Since retiring 2 years ago, I've made this a personal study of mine, the former War Powers Resolution. And I feel that the current effort is basically pablum. It really takes only a tiny step back toward what the Constitution says. requires, and is primarily undertaken to overcome a constitutional crisis which could have occurred under the 1973 resolution, which I agree is partially unconstitutional. I think my question is there any perspective or possibility that within this law, as it becomes amended, there will be a definition of what war is and distinguishing it from other types of use of military force? Without going into the details, I can tell you that this will not help and it will not succeed unless these definitions occur.
Let's look at that, Edward. Professor Zelizer, can you speak to Edward's question?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Look, I think there's three things that can come out of the debates over this commission report beyond the consultation and new committee. The first is defining what deployments are allowed by a president in what situations without congressional declaration of war. I think that's the key issue. And the more we can spell that out, if this becomes legislation, that's the most important thing, because it then gives Congress muscle to stop something, and it gives muscle in the courts to challenge presidential decisions. The second thing is Congress will have to use the muscle it already has, not just the budget. It also has the power to hold hearings, the power to cause political problems for the president, to mobilize public opinion, and that's not something that can be legislated. And finally, the one thing we haven't talked about are voters themselves. Ultimately, Congress is not just a profession. It's an elected office. And politicians think about the consequences of their decisions on Election Day. And voters have to bear some culpability for this war.
But we go to war in months or weeks or even days. We elect every couple of years at most.
No, absolutely. But if we then legitimate the Congress through incumbency or the president that has done something which is seen as wrong, we will only facilitate future conflicts and future mobilization. So it's part of the puzzle. We can't ignore it.
Senator Gorton, do you see the potential here implicit in what you've just proposed with this commission, or do you even see it as important to more closely define what war is? I mean, as Doris Kearns Goodwin and others point out, these days you can reach out anywhere in the world and, you know, bring down missiles in no time. But just because we can do it doesn't mean it's less than war. If we go after nukes in Iran, if we should do that, presumably that would turn into war.
In our proposal, we don't use the word war, but we do come up with some fairly precise definitions that probably aren't going to cover every instance, and let me set them out for you.
Mm-hmm.
First, we say that this consultation is required in connection with a three-word, significant armed conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And significant armed conflict means any conflict expressly authorized by Congress or any combat operation by U.S. armed forces lasting more than 1 week or expected by the president to last more than 1 week.
Senator, on that point, may I ask one
question? Yeah? No, hold
okay,
on.
Okay.
And then we say these things aren't significant armed conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Actions taken by the president to repel attacks, mm-hmm. to prevent imminent attacks on the United States, limited acts of reprisal against terrorists or states that sponsor terrorism,
mm-hmm.
humanitarian missions, investigations or acts to prevent criminal activity abroad, covert operations, and there's a statute on covert operations
mm-hmm.
already on the books, training exercises or missions to protect or rescue American citizens or military or diplomatic personnel abroad. So the definitions are there. Will they cover every conceivable thing that might happen? Probably not, but they'll cover an awful lot of them.
Let me ask you about just one. Would raining cruise missiles on Iran for 6 days under this proposal qualify as a significant armed conflict?
Well, I hate to try to deal with something that is...
But that's so real. I mean, it ought to address that, right?
It almost certainly, if we did that, would last more than 6 days, because there'd be a response on their part, and under those circumstances, the answer to your question would be yes.
Mm-hmm. Doris, do you think we're getting closer to what the founders intended, or maybe closer to something most workable for this century?
Well, I think what's so good about the timing of this commission report is that we do have two new presidents coming in, one of two new presidents coming in, and if they can really get to talk about this during the campaign
and commit themselves to really trying to work with Congress to make this thing happen, that's the best situation we can be in. Because once the president gets in office, if you ask him to do anything that looks like it's limiting his powers, they have this tendency, we got to protect the presidency. So hopefully the timing of this is just right, that it's something on people's minds. We've got two candidates. We've got a Congress that wants to have something done. In the course of the debate, these things can get refined. But I think it's just a great idea to get them started. And this resolution, the way it's defined right now, is a great starting point for it.
Have Baker and Christopher gone out and collared their party's presumed nominees here? Do they have Obama and McCain lined up to support this? Do you know?
No, let me answer that, that question.
Yes, sir.
The two former secretaries of state have each spoken briefly to the candidates and at greater length to their campaign staffs. But they did not get the formal report until yesterday, just shortly before it was issued to the public. I think both of them have issued, you know, mildly favorable responses to it, that this is something they need to look into. But, of course, they do. Now, during the course of the campaign, they can be asked what their view of it is. And we will do all we possibly can after one of the two is a president-elect to have a more intense briefing during that during the transition time.
Well, there's the news, and it's relevant as can be. Former Republican Senator Slade Gorton of Washington State, member of the commission, thanks for your service, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
Julian Zelizer at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. It's always great to speak with you. Thank you for joining us on this important issue, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
And Doris Kearns Goodwin, you're generous with your time, and thank you as well for your work with the commission. Thanks for being here today,
you're
Doris.
You're welcome, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.